Well, last week in our study, we were looking at verse 6, that Paul's fixation on making sure that the readers of his letter understand that grace and works are diametrically opposed as issues in relation to the larger plan. We've been arguing for some time now that Paul's intent in Romans 9, 10, and 11 is to clarify God's larger plan, a plan larger than what he had actually revealed in the Old Testament, and a plan larger than the people of Israel had ever gotten a glimpse of, because he didn't tell them. Then when the shift occurred, there was this massive shift, as we've said, in focus in both what I call big T theology, the character and attributes of God, and in the audience that was going to be addressed by this God. The issues of grace being introduced into the mix with a heavy-duty focus so that the shift would shift off of God as a judge, a rule-giver, a sovereign king over a nation in this world, and shift that to a grace orientation where he builds a new organism called the church for a part in the overall kingdom plan. But that shift created the necessity for Paul to explain what was going on, because the Jews were adamant that Christianity was an aberrant kind of theological thing and it was heresy and all that. And of course, the Gentiles were delighted to discover that God was open to their need and that he was opening the door to them. That's basically the big picture thing. So we've been working our way through Paul's words here in chapter 11 to see what he's saying about the shift in focus from justice to grace, because that's really what's going on. At the end of chapter 10, the last thing he says is a quote about God holding out his hands all day long to a group of people who were unpersuaded and argumentative constantly. That quote and that concept would naturally settle into the typical human heart as requiring a response by God that was equal to the behavior. So in chapter 11, as the chapter opens, Paul is going to address that natural thought that if this is the way these people are, then God's not going to have anything to do with them anymore. He's finally gotten fed up with it and he's done. And the question then is that true? And the answer is absolutely not. It's not true. But the reason it's not true is because of verse 6. There is this issue of grace. Grace does not take people's responses or lack thereof to God into account when God decides to be gracious to somebody. And there are natural history things like sending rain on the just and the unjust. That's a gracious activity. You can see why God might send rain on the just, but how in the world would you justify him sending rain on the unjust when they deserve a drought? So there is this shift, because in the Old Testament, if you didn't behave yourself, you got a drought. And if you did behave yourself, you got rain. Well, in the New Testament, the focus is on a shift in that way. So the issue is a shift from justice to grace. But that does not mean that somehow God's words to the fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, those men who believed him, it does not mean that those words that he spoke to them have to be reinterpreted so as to reduce their meaning to nothing. That's the whole idea that the church has become some kind of spiritual form of Israel, and therefore all the promises that God made to the nation of Israel are transformed into some kind of spiritual something or other that applies to the church, and in a little while you have nothing. It's just meaningless words. Because you can't spiritualize some words without destroying their meaning. And there were many promises given to Israel, to the fathers who believed him, that if you spiritualize them, you destroy them. They don't have any content anymore. Because that's the case, there are many, in spite of the fact that that destruction is real, that if you spiritualize normal words until they don't mean what they say, then you've destroyed them. even though that's true, there are many today that argue that Israel doesn't have any future with God. And they say that even now, after 1948. But it's apparent, I think, from Paul's emphatic denial in chapter 11 that God has not thrust his people away. Means that his people that he, Paul says, foreknew and in verse 5, elected, is a total rejection of this argument that God has finally gotten fed up with these people. They're constantly unbelieving and they're constantly argumentative, and if you deal with them in justice, they're out of here. But that's Paul's whole point. He's not dealing with them in justice. So to further that argument, Paul appealed to this shift in theology from justice to grace. He deals with the issue in the shift from justice to grace and Israel's commitment to justice, because that's the issue in verse 7 where we're going this evening. What Israel is seeking for, it has not obtained, but those who were chosen obtained it, and the rest were hardened. And we'll get into the hardening processes next week. But the whole thing here is that in our last study, we were seeing that the essential nature of grace is its absolute separation from the methodology of works in view of this main question. Who's going to obtain acceptance from God and participate in the ultimate outcome of the plan? Who are they who are going to be able to participate in this larger plan once it's fulfilled? And the answers are one of two. Either those who accomplish a certain kind of work that enables them to be qualified, or those to whom God has graciously extended an invitation to become participants. You can almost hear the echoes of that story that Jesus told about the guy who prepared the big feast, and then he sent out and told everybody that they were to come because the feast was ready, and then one after another, all these friends that this guy had started making their excuses why they couldn't come. So, the master of the feast sent his servants out and said, get everybody out there that has got nothing else to do, or if they're hungry or whatever, just beat the bushes and bring them in here until my house is full. And so they just went out, and they didn't matter if they were friends or if they knew him or any of that. Just get them in here. That's kind of what's going on here. Israel didn't want God on God's terms. They didn't want the plan on God's terms. They wanted the plan on their terms, and they wanted God on their terms, and that's impossible. They become God as soon as God has to be according to their terms. That's just impossible. It's the most ridiculous, irrational thought that there is, and yet that's where the whole nation was going. So this evening what we're going to try to do is follow Paul down this path that he is talking about in terms of who gets to participate. And verse 7 starts it out by a summoning to a conclusion. When he says, what then? This is one of 12 times in the gospel here in Romans where Paul expresses his way of reasoning by setting forth a fundamental claim or set of claims and then summoning his readers to draw a conclusion. He does this all the way through Romans. He'll say this and this and this, and then he'll say, okay, what should we conclude from this? What then? And he does that over and over and over. So it's his way of not only calling his readers to buy into it, which is, I think, a necessary thing. If you just lay this truth out and don't ask anybody to draw any conclusions, that's exactly what will happen. So they won't draw any conclusions. It'll just go by the way. So Paul constantly was saying, okay, this and this and this is true. Now what? Well, according to verse 6, if it's by grace, it is not by works. That destroys grace. Works destroy grace. Grace is no longer grace if there is works in there. So what should we conclude? What's the conclusion that we should draw? And this summons to a conclusion is Paul's way of insisting that a person cannot interact with truth and then set it aside without allowing it to take its place in the way we look at life. We are very adept at this. We listen and we hear, and then we just go on about our business like we never heard it at all. This is Paul's attempt to stop that, to say, look, this is truth. Because it's truth, you dare not walk away from it without drawing the right kinds of conclusions, because it's truth, and there are real consequences built in to ignoring or not believing or walking away from the truth. And the thing is for Paul that truth is different from information. Truth is not given to give us information. Truth is a part of a bigger issue. Information is a necessary first step in the process, but truth is designed to guide us. It's designed to give us direction for our choices. And when truth is set aside, that just indicates that man's lack of participation in what God wants for him, which is life, is willful. He's rejecting God as God. When anytime anybody hears something that is the Word of God and says, well, I'm not going there, what they're basically doing is rebelling against the reality of God. He is God. It is true. It has to be accepted as truth, and that means behavior needs to be in harmony with that. Truth is not revealed to give men options about how they go about living. Reality exists. It can't be created by wishful thinking, and it can't be altered by willful or wishful rejection. Reality is real, and as a consequence, all of this information that truth brings to us is arguing that we need to be aligned with reality, because it is. I ponder this when I give any length of time to think about the eternal consequences that are built into this whole creation thing. When sin entered into the world, the awesome consequences of sin being responded to by a God of justice and judgment are just beyond comprehension. They're just so, it's just almost impossible to think in terms of the eternal consequences of the rejection of the truth. But there isn't any way out of that. It is. And therefore, adjusting is something we need to do. So, reality doesn't posit options. It just is. And when it's presented to us by divine revelation, it is not giving us, well, you can do this if you like, or you cannot do this if you like. It's just stating this is the way it is. And adjusting to it or not adjusting to it are the only two options you got. So truth is not revealed to give us options. It's revealed to summon us to participation in the reality of life by truth. The summons to life, it's been set up to be, in a sense, a summons to death in the way that men think, because men fear participation in life, but that's a ridiculous fear unless you consider life to be death and, alternatively, death to be life. When people hear God say something and they say, oh no, that's going to affect my life in this way, I don't want my life affected in this way, what they're actually saying is, I don't believe that life is going to be beneficial or pleasant. I think life's going to be horrible. I'm not going to go into that horrible pit. And they don't even realize that what they're saying is, life is death. And I don't want to go there. So that's the whole issue. Men have been so deceived by the adversary into thinking that God's going to do some dastardly thing to them if they trust Him and walk with Him. And they've bought into that so deeply that even believers who have, quote unquote, known the Lord for years, still have no real confidence that God's truth leads to life. I heard one of the saddest things I've heard in a long time this morning after Sunday school was over, because there was some prayer requests made And one of the prayer requests was for a man who's got cancer, and they wanted us to pray that this cancer treatment stuff would go well with him so that he could be healed of his cancer, but instead it was making him horribly sick and his life was absolutely miserable going through this. And I wanted to say, why? Why are we doing this to ourselves? Why are we exalting physical life to the point that will actually destroy the quality of our physical life just to try to cling to it a little bit longer? It doesn't make any sense to me. There was another guy that had the same problem that was mentioned right after that one, and he's got cancer, and he's having a terrible time adjusting to the treatment and all. And most people don't realize that the treatment sometimes is as deadly as the disease, because a lot of that stuff they pump into you is just poison. But my question is this: why is it that we're so afraid of life? I'm convinced that Satan has tricked us into believing that the truth believed will lead us to disaster. And there's no argument. At the physical level in this world, Jesus even said that. If you want to live, you're going to have to die. You take up your cross and die daily, or you can't be my disciple. One of my good friends preached a sermon to the missionaries in Alaska when I was up there, and his sermon was that life was experienced by going into the graveyard. That the real issues are not right now. The real issues are what happens beyond the grave. Whenever you are put in a grave, the promise is resurrection. And resurrection, this promise is glory inescapable and incomparable. That's the scenario that has been painted for us in the scripture that none of us buy. Well, I don't mean none. But even, just think of the disciples. Jesus said three times to them in the Gospel of Mark, he was going up to Jerusalem, they were going to put him to death, and on the third day, rise from the dead. They got the first part of that down cold. Let's go up and die with him. They had no connection with that resurrection thing. It was so far under their radar that they had never even, it didn't connect. It even says, they didn't understand the statement. Well, they didn't. But we're 2,000 years beyond that. We should understand it. We should have a hope that guides us in the decisions we make. And if that means going through all this terrible treatment for cancer to stay alive a little longer, then fine, if that's the thing that's driving it. But I've got this sneaking hunch that that's not what's driving it. It's not, God, how can you use me going through this mess for the sake of those that are around me? That's not the answer. The question is, God, how can I stay alive a little bit longer? I may be wrong about the motivation, but I heard of a, and I don't know if I said this last week or not, but I heard a lady recently who professed to be a believer for years and years and years, and she thought she was having a heart attack, and she said that was a terrifying experience. Then I understand to some degree, but I also understand that terror is not supposed to be our response to the things that are going on, because we have these promises. The truth brings life. That's the reason why Paul says, what then? We need to draw a conclusion that's true so we can live by it. So what is the conclusion that he wants us to draw? According to verse 7, that which Israel is seeking for, it has not obtained, but those who were chosen did obtain it. That's what we're supposed to conclude. What Israel was seeking for, it did not get, but those who weren't looking for it got it. But the reason they got it is because they were chosen by God for the experience of grace. So the conclusion is the truth, that grace ceases to be grace if any argument is made that mingles grace and works together. Grace means God is deliberately being kind and gentle and patient and all those things we don't deserve because He wants to be that way toward us. That's grace. Works is we're going to try to force God's hand to get this and this and this by doing this and this and that. That's the difference between works and grace. Works wants to keep everything under our control so we can do what we think we can get out of God something by doing it this way. And grace says we have to abandon all of that and let God be the gracious God that He is to us. The conclusion begins with the description of the commitment of Israel to the big T theology of God in verse 7. What is Israel seeking for? Well, the answer to that is multi-tiered. On the one hand, they are seeking for a right relationship with God as they see Him. Because in their minds, that's the only way they can escape the condemnation that is going to come upon the heads of all those who don't see God as they see Him. The problem with that is that they see God as a just judge who is intolerant of disobedience. He's intolerant of bad behavior, and therefore, if you want a right relationship with Him, you have to behave yourself. You have to. And with that view of God, they put themselves in the box of the impossible. Nobody's going to argue that if you want to get along with God, you ought to do what He tells you. Nobody's going to say, no, that ain't true. The problem with that is, where are you going to get the capacity to behave yourself? That's the real issue. If God is this kind of a God and you must do what He tells you in order to obtain any good benefit from Him, then you're sunk. Because we are sinful. The whole record of the Bible is men have become overcome by sin. So in that hopeless scenario, the only options you got are to go to the temple and proudly tell God how good you've been this week. Or you can go like the sinner and beat on your chest and not even lift your head to heaven and say, God, be propitious toward me, the sinner. You've got those two options. And Jesus already told us which option produces life. And you stop and think about it. Why is it so hard for human beings to say, I was wrong? Why is that so hard to say? I think it has to do with our big T theology. So that's one of the issues. Israel had a theology of God as a judge. But there were a couple other things that were underlying that issue of God as a judge. The first one that underlies it is that this fixation upon God as a judge is that God is primarily focused on justice as the defining characteristic of God. God is just above all other things. That was the underlying error of first century Jewish theology. God is just above all things. He is not just above all things. If He was just above all things, He would have no problem condemning sinners and putting them where they belong. That's justice. If He was just above all things, there would be all kinds of condemnation rain down on the heads of every sinful creature without any hesitation on God's part because He's just. You're just getting what you got coming. What are you crying about? What are you whining about? You're just getting what you've earned. And that's the concept of God as a just judge. He is not just above all things because if He were, there wouldn't be anything left of His creatures. I really believe that that was what was behind Jesus' confrontation of the religious establishment in Matthew. There are two texts in Matthew, chapter 9, verse 13, where He says, you guys need to go and learn what this means. I desire mercy and not sacrifice, which is a quote from Hosea 6:6. He said, you guys need to go and learn what this means. I desire mercy and not sacrifice. And in that context, He's talking to religious people who don't want Him showing mercy. They want Him to be fair, just. And then in Matthew 12, verse 7, because they didn't go and learn that, they found themselves criticizing Jesus' disciples. And Jesus said, if you had learned what it meant, I desire mercy and not sacrifice, you wouldn't have condemned these innocent people. Which means that Jesus taught that above the issue of justice is the desire to be merciful. And if that's not true, then we have no gospel. If the gospel isn't a declaration that there's something more important to God than being just, then we don't have a gospel. Because the gospel, as we understand it, is God taking on the burden of justice in the person of His own Son, allowing Jesus to satisfy the need and the demand of justice so that something better can be done. So that the statement, "I desire mercy and not sacrifice," doesn't mean I don't want y'all sacrificing. It just means I'd prefer you be fixed on mercy so that your sacrificing means something good. The quote clearly indicates that God has a preference that pushes mercy above sacrifice, which is a human performance issue that are wrapped up in justice issues. Human performance issues, as we said last time, demand that God's justice come into play. When a man does something with the expectation that justice will reward him for his good, and he does evil with the expectation that God's going to hammer him for it, what his works are doing is demanding that justice take its place in this scenario. And Jesus and Paul said, "Look, you do not want justice to come into play. That will eliminate your experience of life altogether. What you really want is mercy to come into play." And the divine preference for mercy clearly indicates the rationale for the gospel of the death of Jesus as the Redeemer champion, so that grace can then be extended without compromising justice. It's one thing to say justice is absolutely crucial, because it is. It's one of the attributes of God. You can't contradict it without destroying it. But if you have a God who's willing to meet the demands and the burden of justice himself for the sake of people who can't, wouldn't in the first place, and can't after the fact, then you've got another attribute coming into play here. And it's rooted in this concept of mercy and the grace of God. That's one of the underlying things in Jewish theology. They didn't like grace. They wanted a way to demand that justice be applied to them for the good they've done. I don't know if the evil that they did ever crossed their minds as also demanding justice's involvement. I mean, I think it's kind of like, "We're going up to Jerusalem to die, and on the third day we'll rise." No, well, I don't know anything about that rising thing. Well, it's kind of like, I want justice to play fair with me. I want him to reward me for the good I've done without giving any thought to the other side of that coin. What happens if the biblical statement that there is none good but God only is true, and I want God to reward me for the good I've done? It means I've done nothing good, and therefore there will be no reward. And what's the alternative? That's the first thing that's underneath this fixation on God as judge. The second is the level of intensity. Because it says in verse 7 that Israel is seeking for something. You remember back there in chapter 10 that where it said Israel is zealous for God, verse 2? But not in accordance with knowledge, for not knowing about God's righteousness and seeking to establish their own, they did not subject themselves to the righteousness of God. The word translated seeking in verse 3 of chapter 10 is defining a desire they have, a goal they have in mind, and the goal is to establish their own righteousness. And the outworking of that was that they would not subject themselves to the righteousness of God, which meant that they were now in rebellion against God's righteousness because they were intent on pursuing their own. Well, that word for seeking is the basic word for seeking. It means that you're set up a goal and that's what you're chasing. When we get to verse 7 of chapter 11, it says, "That which Israel is seeking for, it has not obtained." That's exactly what he had said earlier when he said in chapter 9 that Israel, pursuing a law of righteousness, did not arrive at it. And the Gentiles, in verse 30, didn't pursue righteousness and they got it. Well, in 11:7, it says Israel was seeking for something and didn't get it. The word seeking there is exactly the same word as in chapter 9, with this exception. It has a prefix on it as an intensifier. And that raises the level of the intensity of the commitment of the hearts of Israel. They're not just seeking to establish their own righteousness. They're desperately pursuing the establishment of their own righteousness. This is a goal that they've raised to a higher level of intensity. And they want to be accepted by God on the basis of their own righteousness, which translates into, you got to accept me, I've been obedient to what you've said. It's just trying to control what God's going to do with me. Well, Paul has already established in chapter 10 that Israel wanted to establish this righteousness in rebellion against the righteousness of God, but by this means he also established the fact that the fundamental root of their desire was to prove they weren't bad and that God owed them a place in his larger plan. And that's what I was asking earlier when I said, why is it so hard for us to say I was wrong? Well, part of that difficulty is because it makes me out to be bad. And we just don't want to be recognized as bad. We don't want to recognize ourselves that way, and we certainly don't want anybody else looking at us and saying, you know, you're just bad. If they really mean it. There is just something about the ego that's involved in that. And so, Israel is pushing the envelope in verse 7, adding this intensifier to their seeking. They're not just wanting to establish their own goodness before God. They've placed this goal above everything else. And by doing that, what have they done? They have forced grace out of the picture. According to verse 6, you cannot bring works into the mix without destroying grace, which means you just shove it aside. Well, in verse 7, the conclusion that we're supposed to draw is that Israel was so intent on maintaining a justice-focused obedience methodology that they forced grace to the side. Get out of here. We don't want that. So, Paul was uncompromising regarding the outcome of their distortion of their theology. He said Israel had not, is not, and will not achieve their objective. What Israel is seeking for, it has not obtained, it is not obtaining, it will not obtain it. Why? Because they're seeking it by works. If they do that, they're forcing grace to take a non-participatory position. Just get out of here, grace. Let's keep this on a judicial basis. And if they do that, they will not obtain this acceptance by God that they're really looking for. It is impossible for a sinner to establish him or herself as good. This is fundamental to biblical truth. It's the statement that Jesus made when the rich young ruler came running up to him and said, "Good master, what good thing can I do to inherit eternal life?" And he says, "Why do you call me good? There's nobody good but God." And then he said, "You know the commandments. Which ones?" And Jesus quotes the last six. Ignores the first four. Quotes the last six, which have all to do with how this rich man had treated his neighbors. And the rich man had the blindness and the gall to say, "Oh, I've been doing a good job of that ever since I was a kid, all my life." And Jesus said, in effect, "Oh, really? Let's test that a minute. Go sell everything that you have and give it to these people that you've been treating so well all your life and come follow me." Uh-oh. "Oh, Jesus, I can't do that. Can you imagine? I've got $5.6 million I'd just have to divest myself of, and then how would I be able to pay for all this stuff I'm so used to spending all this money on? I can't do that. You're asking too much. All I'm asking you to do is what the sixth commandments require of you that you said you've been doing all your life. That's all I'm asking you to do. Prove it." "Well, I can't prove it." Turns around and walks away. Great sadness, because he had many possessions. All that illustration proves is that there truly is none good. You push the envelope, you'll find the rotten core, no matter who it is, where they are, or whatever their claims are. A sinner cannot establish himself as good before God. But Israel was hyper-intensive in their pursuit of their self-righteousness, according to verse 7. They were hyper-intensive. They were really seeking for this self-righteous status. And he says, what should we conclude? They will not obtain it. They have not obtained it. They are not obtaining it. It's beyond their reach. That's a solemn warning to anybody and everybody who thinks that they can come before God and say, because I have done this, I want you to be fair to me and do whatever. You bring fairness and justice into the picture and you've just sold yourself down the river. And it's a permanent, eternal death flow. But on the other hand, we are supposed to conclude this, that those who are chosen obtained it. Now, what he's saying is in verse 3 and 4 and 5, that Elijah had complained that there wasn't anybody but himself who had been faithful to Yahweh in the northern kingdom. And God says, no, no, you're wrong there. There are 7,000 that I have kept from bowing the knee to Baal and kept from kissing his image. I have kept them from this for their sake, for their good result. They were no different than all those other Israelites, but I got in their way one at a time and I said, you're not going to go there. That is death and you're not going there. I'm going to keep you alive. I don't care what it costs me. I'm going to keep you alive. You're not going there. He stepped in front of them. He said, I preserve them for their own sake. This is grace. But he calls it grace. And Paul said, if it's grace, then you're not dealing with justice anymore. You're talking about God taking the initiative to do something good for somebody who doesn't deserve it at all. And he says, those that God chooses to step in front of and block their pursuit of death, obtain acceptance before God, because that's what the Jews were seeking and couldn't get, and the Gentiles weren't interested in pursuing it, and they got it anyway. That's the whole thing, is that the gospel came to the Gentiles. It did not come as law. Paul didn't preach, if you'll do this and this and this and this and this and this and this, the God of the Jews will finally accept you. He didn't say any of that. He said, God, who controls all of everything because he's the creator of all, sent his own son to die in your place because you sinned, and he did that because he wants good for you. He wants life for you. And if you will trust his promise, you will have it. That's God stepping in front of someone with a promise of life. And he says, in this case, that we should conclude that when God makes this decision to block somebody from the pursuit of death, he makes it work. So, the gift of life from God is directly related to his deliberate action on the behalf of sinners by grace. And the conclusion continues in verse 7 and then is justified in verses 8, 9, and 10. But the rest of the conclusion is that the rest, those he did not choose, were hardened. Now, the King James says blinded. I don't know why. The TR, which is the Greek text behind the King James, uses the word parao, and it means to harden. I don't know why they thought it was tuflao, or whatever that word is for blinding. I'm just calling out of my memory, but it's something along that line. I don't know why they mistranslated it. The fact is, the Greek is clear. They are hardened. Well, what does that mean? Well, the word hardened means to put a shell around something or someone that becomes a protective barrier from any outside input. It's kind of like, is it called an exoskeleton? Instead of having bones on the inside and flesh on the outside, you have this hardened case on the outside and that. Well, it's kind of like that. You step on a worm and it squishes because it doesn't have one of those hardened shells. But you get these big old beetles that come around every once in a while. And man, they're tough because they got this really hard shell around them. Well, that's the word. They were hardened. And the verb is passive. It happened to them. But There is a issue of this passiveness, meaning that there was this hardened process imposed on them by somebody else. But however we take this passivity, and we'll be looking at how we should take it in verses 8, 9, and 10 in the weeks to come, the point is that it cannot be reckoned apart from verse 7, where Israel has adamantly established the pursuit of self-righteousness as their intense goal. If that's your goal, hardening is just automatic. It will happen to you. Because when you insist on God treating you justly, you are forcing His hand. And if He decides to listen to you, that's called hardening. If the goal of Israel is settled, if the goal of anybody is settled, I want God to treat me justly. If that's a settled goal, that person's hardness is beyond breaking. He'll never be able to see anything beyond that. I believe that that's the issue of people crossing a certain line, becoming irredeemable. I believe that when the angels made their choice and rebelled against God, they did it in such a setting that the choice once made hardened them permanently. They're irredeemable, and that's why there was no sacrifice for them. I believe that God loved His angels when He created them, and I believe that if they had been in a state kind of like humans were, that if there had been a possibility of redemption for them and reconciliation to God for them, then God would have made a sacrifice sufficient to take care of that. But He didn't. The Bible is clear. Jesus didn't die for angels. Well, that only implies one thing, and that is the hardness that occurred when they made that decision was permanent. Well, the same thing goes then with anybody who is pursuing a course that is building up to a decision where they're going to say, okay, this is the only way I'll accept an approach to God. It must be on this basis. What basis? He must treat me justly. If that happens, it's all over. And you stop and think about it. Which of the religions in the world do not have that as their goal?